Great shoes, which I need, is a bit of an overstatement, I think, especially if you saw my closet. My name is Mildred, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And I'm really glad to be here. I've had a wonderful weekend, and I want to thank you, OK, and Dean, and Bill, and Marlene, and all the committee for your wonderful hospitality and the warmth of the rest of you. You know, I travel a lot, and I go to many places, and I must say the warmth that I have experienced here and the willingness of people to come out of themselves and to welcome me and the others, I'm sure, has been quite extraordinary. So I thank you for that, and I thank you for the beautiful room and that wonderful basket. Where are you, Barbara? Pardon me? Okay. First things first. So it's been wonderful to see friends from months and years gone by, and to be with the other speakers, and certainly to be with Bill and Marlene, who saw me through a very bad time. I fell in love with them immediately, and that has just grown. You're a wonderful voice. Maybe we should import you to Toronto. There's a thought. Okay. Many years ago, there was a man who walked the earth who told this story. And I would like to share that story with you, because if I get sidetracked, you know what I came here to say. And the story is this. This rich man had two sons. And one of these sons was restless, irritable, and discontented. And he said to his father, "It's not really cool here at your house. I want my inheritance. I'm out of here." And he got his inheritance, because the father knew there was no sense trying to talk this kid into staying at home. And the story says he took his inheritance and he went into a far country. And a famine came upon the land, and it says he lived riotously. Every alcoholic should know about that one. He lived riotously, and the famine came upon the land, and he had spent all his substance. And the story goes on to say, "And no man gave him anything." That's the story of my life. No man gave me anything, because no man could give me anything. Many years ago, Chuck Chamberlain was a mentor of mine. He tried to pound some sense into me. And he used to say, "Miss Mildred, you already are everything that you can be." When you're stoned, what does that mean? And he'd say, "And you know everything that you can know." He said, "This is as good as it gets." You know, if I had had the sense to know what he was saying, I would have been very disappointed. Instead, I just thought he was ridiculous. Well, this kid said no man, the story goes, no man gave him anything. And he wound up in the pig pen. And the story says he wound up eating not what the pigs ate, but what the pigs left over. I think that's saying he was in a state of complete degradation, a state of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, a young Jewish boy in a pig pen eating what the pigs left over. And it says that while he was there, he came to himself. I think he took his step one while he was in the pig pen. And he said to himself, "This is no good. I don't want to stay here." And he looked out, and his motivation may have been all wrong, but he said, "You know, my father's servants, they eat much better than I'm eating here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go home, and I'm going to say the right words to my dad. I'm going to say, 'Father, I have sinned before heaven and against thee, and I'm not worthy to be called your son. Let me go to the pig pen.'" Because he knew he would eat better there. Now, obviously, something happened to him. It does not say how long his journey took. It does not say what he did on this journey. But something happened to him, because when he got to the presence of his father, what he said was, "Father, I have done bad. I have sinned before heaven and against you, and I'm not worthy to be called your son." But he didn't say, "Let me go to the pig pen." Something had happened to him. He must have done his steps as he went along the path, because he must have had a spiritual awakening, because he understood he didn't belong in the pig pen. He was the son of the household. He belonged in the household. And that is the gift that has been given to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're sitting here sober and you've been through these steps and you know you belong here, you too have been rocketed into the fourth dimension, because there is only one. That's the gift. When I came here and saw you have been rocketed into the fourth dimension, I knew that this was going to be a fabulous convention, because the emphasis is absolutely correct, because that's what I believe we're doing here in Alcoholics Anonymous. It isn't about just staying sober. That would be good if that was the gift that was given to us. That would be good, but that isn't what I think it's really about. The whole book talks about the spiritual dimension of the life that we can live after we get this gift of sobriety. Sobriety, abstinence is absolutely essential, but the quintessential aspect of this program is the spiritual life that comes to us. And the spiritual life, of course, is the life we live with one another. It's not the life on the mountaintop meditating. See, I think if you really have tasted the fourth dimension, you're out with your brothers, because you want to say to them, come in, it's okay. This is how we do it here, and if you want what we have and are willing to make some changes, you too can have this way of life. So, if I don't say anything else worthwhile, I've shot my bolt. I'm told that there was a conference in Miami recently, and many thousands of people gathered there, but they canceled the conference. Can you imagine that? It was a nudist conference. And the reason they canceled it was everybody was comparing. Nobody was identifying. Now, we know how important it is that we identify with one another. So I'm going to ask you to, if you will, to participate with me. Y'all can raise your hands. You willing to do that? Good. All right. I have made up my own list of 20 questions, because it seems to me that some of you certainly will not be able to identify with the drama of my life. And if you can't identify with me, then maybe this meeting will be very short. So, part A are the easy questions. How many in here were born on a farm in Saskatchewan? How many here are German by descent? All right, thank you. How many here were raised Roman Catholic? I know one for sure. How many here are the youngest of 10 children? One, two, okay, thank you. That's part one. How many passed? Now we come to part two. We'll just see how much identification there is. How many here were Roman Catholic sisters for 15 years? Don't you put up your hand. I stand alone. How many here were ever locked up? Lots of hands. You're a bad bunch. How many here were locked up in jail? Even ex-nuns get locked up in jail. Can you believe it? How many here were locked up in mental institutions, psych wards, or insane asylums? Lots of takers. How many were locked up 32 times? One, two, three. I have three who are identifying with me. How many here were diagnosed with all types of mental illness? Lots of takers. How many here have ever been tied to the bed? Thursday night speaker as well. Now, I hope you looked to see whose hands were up, because there's a part two. How many here were tied to the bed, but not with Good Time Charlie? one taker. Okay, thank you. How many here slept with their psychiatrist? How many here married their psychiatrist? It was legal. They told me it was cheaper, too. It didn't prove to be that way for either one of us, trust me. Well, that kind of takes care of that identification. There's not much of it, okay? How about this? Part three. How many here? Oh, shock treatments. Did we do that? How many here had shock treatments? How many here had 38 shock treatments? I tell you something, that will light up your life if you need it. All right, now to part three. How many here never felt, let me put it another way. How many here always felt different and alone? The Al-Nons can put up their hands, too. Everybody in the room pretty well. How many here felt they were dropped into the wrong family? Yeah. Wouldn't our parents love to see this? How many of you was one drink too many because 50 weren't enough? Yeah, now we've got lots of identification. How many here believe that the main problem rested in their mind? Yeah. Okay. You can't identify with the drama of my life, just as I can't identify with the drama of your life in its particulars. But I can certainly identify with your feelings of despair. I can identify with your feelings of being alone, of your feelings of not being good enough, of your feeling of being in the wrong place, and how is life ever going to work? Well, the book tells me, you know, what the solution to all that is in the chapter to the agnostic, and I missed that for a lot of years because I thought when it said the main problem rests in the mind, I thought it said the main problem rests in the intellect. And, of course, I have a good intellect, just like many of you do. Most of us do. Maybe all of us. I had no problem going to university and getting degrees. So when I read that, I missed what it was really saying to me. What I understand today is the main problem is inside me, and therefore the solution is going to have to be inside me. And there come the 12 steps, and there comes the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, as it's written out in the big book where it says, spiritual principles would solve all my problems. Yeah, right. I thought men would do that. I thought money would do that. I thought something out there was going to solve my problems. It said in the book, that's what this book is about, to help you find the power that will solve your problem. It says when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out physically. We straighten out in every other way. I thought, you get me fixed up with a house and a man and a job and some self-respect and whatever, and then I'll deal with you, God. And thank goodness it didn't work out that way. You know, and at the end of the steps, it says, what I think has been the theme of my whole life, I can't fix myself. Probably no human power can fix me. And God could and would if he were sought. And that's what we're doing here, isn't it? We're seeking God. We're seeking God in ourselves. We're seeking God around us. We're seeking God in one another. We're seeking God through this program, and it's really all about that. And that's why I think in the chapter to the agnostics, it says, the day will come when you will have to face this. When faced by a crisis that you have created, you will have to say to yourself, either God is everything or God is nothing. And if you haven't reached that point, I'm telling you, you've got a roller coaster ride ahead of you. Because, trust me, I believe that if you stay here, the day will come when you will have to face that. I certainly did, but I certainly was not ready for that yet at the point I'm talking about. How did I get to this place of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization? I mean, after all, when you start out in a respectable German family whose watchword is integrity, and then you go and spend 15 years in a convent, and you wind up sleeping on a park bench, I think you could call that the ultimate cycle downwards. You know, when you start out there and you end there, how does that happen? Well, it started for me, I believe, when I was born. I was born not feeling good. It was to me as if I'd had an implant. And that implant said, you're a nothing, you're a nobody, you're a girl, you'll never amount to anything, life is hard, and so on. And that was confirmed for me when I realized that the person I loved most in the world would crawl into bed with me at night and she would cry. And this was my retarded sister. They called her retarded in those days because 65 years ago they didn't know a whole lot about learning disabilities and so on. And she would cry. They had kept her in grade 3 till she was 16. They didn't know how to handle. She had been injured at birth, and they didn't know how to deal with this. And she knew she was different, and she would cry. And she came to the person that she knew had empathy for her. And, of course, you might as well have taken a 2x4 and smacked me over the back physically. It wouldn't have harmed me as much as I was harmed by this. But I think it was my path. I have learned to look at that and say, I have received great benefits because I don't think it was alcohol that took me to the bottom. That's not the real story of my life. That's not the real story. The real story of my destruction down to Skid Row is the story of somebody who defied God, somebody who could not see beyond herself, who was the ultimate in self-centeredness, and that's what the book says. You know, the real problem is self-centeredness. So I tried to fix her life. I didn't want her to cry. I loved her. And I gave my family their marching orders. They didn't accept what I wanted them to do. You know, and Clancy talks about this as being a disease of perception. And I am so grateful I have heard him over the years talk about this. Because my perception was skewed. You know, what I saw in my family and what my family really were two different things. They loved her as much as I did. They just didn't respond to my controls. I was raised Roman Catholic. I was told God was love, so God's going to fix this. So I tried to get God to do what I wanted. Now, how do you explain that? My sister... Life seemed to go on just as it had been. I would sit outside on the woodpile with my cup of homebrew at 5 years of age, and I would look at the beautiful sunsets, and I don't think they're any more beautiful than in Saskatchewan. And I would go out at night, and I would see the aurora borealis dancing across the sky. And I would think, how can a God who makes that also allow that? What I didn't understand was the kind of God that I believe in today. So I put God on the shelf. I didn't dismiss God, and I didn't really turn against God. I just couldn't understand. It seemed to me that at that time I became an agnostic, even though I said, you know, I wasn't. But it seemed to me that God was kind of a useless twit. You know, I mean, I believe Queen Elizabeth was there, but what earthly good was she? And so what earthly good was God if you had a problem and he didn't solve it? Out of this, you see, came this personality, this hard head that said, you're wrong, I'm right. I see the world correctly. My sister is crying. Somebody should do something about that. And if you didn't see that, as far as I was concerned, I wiped you off out of my consciousness, so to speak. I did something else. I said, you're wrong, and I'm right. Now, if you want a recipe for insanity, try that one on. That will do it. And I put up the walls because you weren't going to get near me. I just didn't. All I could see was me. All I could see was my sister. Nobody else counted. You see, I am described in step 3 in the big book where it says, many times we go out to do good, what seem like good things. We try to manipulate the world to our purposes. It just isn't my business to do that. And that was me. And then at 5, I picked up a drink. You know, I come from a family where there was always alcohol. And my father would have his poker friends in. And so one night, I guess they thought it was cute, and I poured the drinks. And I poured some booze into me. I had no idea of what was going to happen. And I can tell you, I was an alcoholic waiting. I think somebody described it this way. I was a freeze-dried alcoholic waiting for the liquid. What happened to me was amazing. It was unimaginable. It was as if you took off these glasses through which I had been seeing the world, where it said, life is tough, nobody cares, nobody loves me, nobody loves Dora, and, you know, I want to get off this planet as fast as I can. And the lenses changed. And all of a sudden, life was wonderful, you were wonderful, God was wonderful, I was wonderful, everything was working out, and I just loved it. That's what I chased to the gates of insanity and death. And somehow, even in my little mind, I knew that that wonderful feeling came out of a bottle. And as long as the bottle was accessible to me, I could get those lenses changed. I didn't have to do a thing. I didn't have to change. You changed. And that was the miracle. And so I drank whenever, I drank with whomever, I drank whatever, you know, for the rest of the time that I drank. And I'm not saying that I was drunk every day, but I was the kind of drinker, if I could get it, I drank it. Including vanilla and Chanel No. 5, my personal favorite. I keep some around nowadays, and once in a while when I'm going out, I spray it on. And I say to myself, kid, you're progressing. You used to drink this, now you spray it on. That's progress. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a hard drinker, even though I, for some time, could drink many men under the table. There was a time in my life where I drank 52 ounces of hard liquor a day, and I was still walking, and that's a fact. But I'm not a hard drinker. You see, the book says if I'm a hard drinker and I have a reason to stop, I stop. I many times had a reason to stop, and I didn't stop. And you see, the other part of that is, if you take the alcohol away from me, if you think that I'm doing some wild things when I'm drinking, you ought to see me when you take the alcohol away. Because the book says the drinking is only the symptom. So when you see me and I'm drinking alcohol, you're seeing me and the symptom. But when you take that away, that's when you see the real problem. And I am not a beautiful sight. I am self-absorbed. I am self-obsessed. I am self-conscious when I'm not drinking. And that's the way I lived my life. People were puzzled by me. I was puzzled by me. I'm smart. I go to university. I get top grades. I can do that. I can choirs. I can be a great teacher. I can do all kinds of things. But stay sober. And so the way I inside and saw on the out could vary. If drinking, you saw one kind of person. If I wasn't drinking, you saw me. And my mother would say, Mildred's a nice girl when drink. What I get across to her, when I drink, you don't know what's going on, guide. The alcoholic knows me what I'm talking. So I have my own plans for how life is going to work. It always has to be on my terms. At 18, I had to go to a convent. Remember, I said I put God up on the shelf. And so I took him down. I tried religion, but I tried it in my own way. I went to a convent. If you love men, you don't like women, you guzzle booze, and you don't like life, a convent isn't a great place to go. They took me, and I was there for 15 years. I came out of that convent, and I can tell you, I remember standing on the convent steps, January the 10th, 1966. And I stood there with all the hope of a deluded human being. I didn't know the problem was inside. I had spent much of those 15 years at university. I was a well-educated young woman, and I did not know that the problem was inside. I thought it was as simple as taking away my habit giving me back my secular name, I was no longer Sister Mary Eugenia, absolving me from the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and I was going to find my wonderful world out there. You know what I found was the bars, and that was the second thing I tried. I tried men, and you know, I began to drink with some rather high lights. They said they were CEOs and bank presidents and brain surgeons, but I bet they didn't believe either that they were drinking with an ex-nun. At the end of that time, I had gone on a moral landslide, which I will not bother explaining to you. You can figure that one out yourself. And at the end of that time, I wound up in an insane asylum, and from there my brother took me back to the West. And it was there I went to the University Hospital. Now, there it was that I met Dr. Hoffer. Dr. Hoffer used to talk to me about Bill Wilson, and Dr. Hoffer had a partner called Dr. Frank. And these two knew a lot about alcoholism, and they had watched what was happening in my treatment, so to speak. And they went to my doctor and said, we think she should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my doctor, good man that he was, said, oh, we couldn't do that. It would interfere with her treatment. However, he finally acquiesced. And I walked into my first meeting on November the 15th, 1966. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because I'm telling you, all the ways that I tried to fix my life, religion, men, psychiatry, and now AA. I have a brother who died 3 years ago, and when he died, he was sober 49 years. So he would be sober 52 years if he still lived. When I went away to the convent, he was dying, so people said. After I was in the convent a couple of years, my father wrote me this very wonderful letter, and he said, your brother, he said, something has happened to him. He has been transformed. Now, my father was not given to words like that. When he said, your brother has been transformed, he said, I hardly know him anymore. He's so wonderful. He said, this thing called AA has come to Saskatchewan, and your brother has gone. He said, it's so good, I don't know what it is, but he said, it's wonderful. All right, now it's 1966, and the doctors say, I should go to AA. I want to be transformed. I want my father to smile on me. So I go to AA with all the hope in the world. I'm going to be transformed. And I park my hiney on the chair, and I park my hiney on the chair, and I do nothing else, and it's lovely for 3 weeks. And that's about how long it took for the real problem to surface. All the things that I've talked to you about. My defiance of God, my anger with the way the world is, my inability to cope with life. I didn't know how to have relationship. You know, I was a 5-year-old who had put the booze aside. So I know that there are those little things that you can take that also change the way you feel. I've been in many psych wards, and I've taken lots of that stuff. So I knew how to get that stuff, so I sat in AA for 5.5 years stoned. I say that not to get into the drug problem, but to simply say it doesn't work that way. I sat here for 5.5 years, and I'll tell you what I did. I was in Prince Albert, so Cease was my first sponsor. How many of you know Cease? Yeah, you know, he just celebrated 50 years, a dedicated member of AA. And I was going to meetings regularly. I was not drinking. I was trying to read the big book. Cease would call me, and I would go on 12-step calls with him. He would call me at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he'd say, because in those days, they still did that. And he'd say, get your clothes on. I'm going to be at your door in 10 minutes. We're going on a 12-step call. And we'd go. I'm stoned, but I went nevertheless. That's also when I met Chuck Chamberlain. And Chuck used to sit there by the hour and talk to me. But, you know, Chuck also knew you hear when you hear and you see when you see. And at that time, he talked to me, and I couldn't see and I couldn't hear, but he still talked to me. And, you know, all these years later, I know what he said. So I try not to give up on people either. I want to say one more thing about Cease even let me go to the women's jail. He says, now I carried the disease rather than the message. But I went. What I want to say about that is this. I learned from that experience. I'm glad I had that experience because I learned from that experience that I've got to do more than come to meetings. I've got to do more than not drink. I've got to take this program and I've got to take it into me and let it mold me and let it change me. It's not good enough to have it out there. Because if you looked at me from the outside, if you didn't know, if you just knew the things I was doing, you'd have said, she's a good member of AA. And I was not a good member of AA. I was coming to the meetings and eventually I got drunk and I left AA. Not because you people shoved me out. I think back on my years, you know, and all the disgusting things I've done. You know, I always had to have a seat in the front row, drunk or sober. And I'd fall asleep and I'd fall off the chair and fall onto the floor. And I'd go to breakfast meetings and I'd go to sleep in the bacon and eggs. And they'd take me and wipe me off and take me home, etc. I can't say enough about the love that I have received in this program, the love and the compassion and the care that people have taken. Cease used to come and 12-step me. One time I said to Cease, why did you always come? And he said, because we never knew when the call would be the right one. I can't ever remember that I called, that they didn't either come or he sent somebody, but I always got a response. And so it's now I'm drinking, and the last year and a half, I no longer functioned. That was finished. You see, drinking for me went from relief drinking and release drinking to dependency to addiction. And now I needed to drink. And I believe that's what the book is talking about when it says we have lost the power of choice. And when it says there are days on which the alcoholic has no effective mental defense against the first drink, where self-knowledge won't do it, where fear won't keep me sober, that last year and a half, I had more than one convulsion. If you've ever had a convulsion, you know they're not fun times. I had blackouts. I had the DTs, and I couldn't stop. If I had a bottle of booze, that's all I had. No money, nothing. I didn't care. That's when I truly lived one day at a time. And that's how I was on May the 18th when I wound up in a psych ward. The house was gone. The cars were gone. The housekeeper was gone. The money was gone. Everything was gone. And I'm in a psych ward, and there are two men sitting at the foot of my bed, and they really were there. One was a psychiatrist and one was a private detective who'd been hired to find me. And little did I know that that was to be the last of those hospitalizations. Because on the morning of May the 20th, what's your date, Keith? 13th. You beat me by a week. I made up my mind that morning to take my life. Ray O'Keefe says, we come to a line in the sand over which we need not walk. I don't know where your line in the sand is, but I saw mine that morning. As I looked at my life, I was unemployable. I could hardly talk. I was so broken. I was a mess physically. I was a mess mentally. I was a mess spiritually. I was a mess in every way. Nobody wanted me. I was a nasty little piece of work. You know, when people say to you, don't come onto our property, we'll call the police, you have had to have done some really bad stuff. And that's where I was. And I made up my mind that I was going to take my life. That was my cry. And it was in that moment that I had a spiritual experience. And it was as if a giant hand reached into me. I was 40 years old. I had been drinking as much as I could or drugging for 35 years. I had not drawn a sober breath, if I could draw one, that changed the lenses on my glasses. And in the twinkling of an eye, the compulsion to drink was taken from me. And in 29 years and 2 months and a couple of days, I have never had the compulsion to drink. It was gone, and I knew it was gone. It was as if somebody had taken me, and I was facing one direction, and had picked me up and set me that way. And I was looking down a completely different road, and I didn't know how to live on that road. And I said to whatever power there was in that room, I do not know how to live. If I'm going to live this way, you're going to have to send somebody. And I swear to you, there was a rap on the door, and a man stood there. I didn't used to tell this story. I don't know. I felt kind of embarrassed by it. I thought, people, what will they think? You know what I think now? It's my story. It's exactly what happened to me. That's how God dealt with me. And not because I'm special or because I'm unique. I think this is my belief, that every single one of us, we sit in our skin and we have exactly the experiences that we need. I can look back on my years of drunkenness and I can see the spiral downward, and I can see everything that happened to me, right down to that direst poverty, to living on Skid Row, and I can see what it did in my life and how it was necessary, not to becoming rich and powerful, but to surrendering to the grace that we come here for. And so this man stood there, and he said, I saw you at breakfast. He said, are you alcoholic? And I said, yes. Do you want to make something of it? He said, no. I just thought I might come and offer you some help. I said, what had you in mind? You see, spiritual experiences, and we've all had them, they don't change the work we have to do. They're there to achieve a certain purpose. And I believe that the spiritual experience I had was about removing from me the compulsion to drink. It had happened. But now I'm standing on the road, and now I've got to do something. And he said to me, how about going to AA? Repeat to you what I told him. I hated AA, and I hated God. And he said, how about a treatment center? And I, like you, Keith, I don't know what would have happened to me if all there had been at that time was a... He said, how about Dawnwood? And I went through my Rolodex, you know, mentally. Haven't been there, okay. So this was the hospital that Dr. Bell, who was a pioneer in giving good medical care to addicted people, had started. And I went, he took me there, this man did, on Tuesday, so instead of me going out and committing suicide as I had planned that morning, here I was. You see, my plan to commit suicide was, and like Keith said, it's deadly when you get to that place. It's not a big deal either. You just want to get it over with. And instead, that was my cry for help. I think, too, I want to say something else. I don't believe in a God who lets some people get sober and others don't. I think the gift is offered to all of us. And I think we swim in that grace. We didn't create it. We can't earn it, but we do have to accept it. I was not ready to accept grace in 1966. I wanted grace on my terms, not on the terms, on God's terms. I was not ready to accept it. 1973 was a different question altogether. So I got through that treatment center, but I'm not going to AA. I mean, I'm living on Skid Row. We haven't got enough to eat. My husband, that wonderful psychiatrist that I spoke of, he was alcoholic too, had been sober when I met him and was now drinking, and he was depressed. So I'm making $2.20 an hour, and that's what we're surviving on. You know what? I'm grateful for that first year of poverty. I learned something. I learned that I'm not my stuff. I learned that I'm not my house. I learned that I'm none of that stuff, that I'm something infinitely more than that. And after about 6 months, I walked into a meeting of AA. You know why? Because I was at the institution, and a man was in the hallway, and he said, "Mildred, would you like to come to a meeting with me?" And I said, sure. It had been a long time since anybody invited me anywhere. And I went with him to the meeting. I didn't know what I was doing there. I knew it was AA once I got there. I didn't particularly like you. I didn't particularly dislike you, but you were people. And after about 3 months of keeping on coming back and keeping on coming back, I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I caught the spirit. I caught that spirit that's in these rooms. And I personally believe we're not just people helping people. If we think that's what we are, I think we have forgotten the prayer of St. Francis, that we are the channels indeed of the grace of God that flows from one of us to the other, and that those ABCs are really true. One person can't help another, and that I can't help myself, but that we are the instruments for the grace of God to flow through us. So there were two men at this group. My first sponsor that I had gotten didn't take her long. She got drunk. And these two guys, they had read the book, and they took me aside one day, and they said, "You know, you have to do the steps." I said, "I don't know how to do the steps." And they said, "If you will come an hour and a half early every week, we'll come and we'll read the book to you and we'll take you through the steps." And that is precisely what they did. Every week they said, "If you come, we'll be here." And I came and I did what I was told. I had forgot about my degree in theology and all that kind of stuff. It didn't do me any good, you know. And I did what I was told, and I got something out of those steps. I found out who the problem was. I didn't know who the problem was. I thought Mother was the problem, Mother Superior was the problem, the Pope was the problem. Maybe I should go tell him that when he's in Toronto. It was never me. I never looked in the mirror. I always looked at you, and I always had somebody to blame. I was the victim. You were the perpetrators of my problem. And if only you would give me what I needed, I'd be okay. And I learned doing the steps. It was all what was going on inside me. And I haven't fundamentally changed that idea. You don't have to change for me to be okay. Only I have to change. And if I get right with God, as the book says, be sure that your relationship with God is right, and great things will come to pass for you and countless others. And so, my first 7 years, I'll go quickly over this. My first 7 years were years of paying off debts, getting rid of the husband, getting another man who was just as troubled as the first one, and getting a good sponsor. And I got a teaching job again, and I was in, you know, I got back into the real world. That was my first 7 years, and I became a good member of AA. I had a sponsor. I was sponsoring. I was busy. I had a home group, and I'm a great believer in home group. That's, I think, what makes is what part of this is all about. At the end of that, my sponsor took me through the steps again, and I got rid of a whole lot of anger, and it was as if I had the wind on my back. And again, I must say, I believe we get exactly that which we need, because at the end of that time, by a real God shot, I began to buy houses. And I became very rich. And the reason I tell you that is this. It didn't change anything in here. That's the point I want to make. And I think whatever lessons we need, we get. And I had always thought if I could have money, I'd have power and people would love me, da-da-da-da-da-da. And I had to find out. I had the money, I could do what I liked, and it didn't change anything in here. And that was the lesson. And I was busy in AA, and I was busy in school, and I was busy with my little company that I had started. And I was sober 19 years. And my life started to unravel just as surely as it ever had. See, I got very busy, and I think I neglected some of my spiritual duties. And I left my teaching job, and I broke up with the man, and it was about at that time that I met Bill and Marlene. And I went through a period where one day I decided again, I'm doing everything that AA says I ought to do. I don't know what to change. And one more time. See, I'm still the little girl that says, I'm right, you're wrong. Takes a long time to get rid of some of that stuff. I'm still the girl that says, I've got to fix the world. And I didn't even know that that's what I was doing. See, I think that's why I honor all of you who are sober longer than I am, and you keep coming back. I know what you're doing here. I, like you, I don't believe I'm here to help you. I'm here to help myself. I'm here because I need to be here, because I need to keep growing spiritually, because if I don't, I'm going to stagnate. And one day I said, I'm out of here. I don't know what else to do. AA is my last chance in life, and I still am not happy, joyous, and free. And one more time, I had a spiritual awakening. And I must say that the last 8 years have been the most exciting years of my life, because the day came when again I realized I was still trying to fix my life with my intellect. I was still planning and analyzing and all that stuff, and I didn't even know that I was doing it. And the day came when I had to face either God is everything or God is nothing. And I said to myself, God, I don't understand you. I don't understand what that means. But I'm going to try and live that way. And that has made all the difference. And one day the phone rang, and it was a Jesuit that I didn't know. He said, would you like to give retreats? I said, Father, I'd love to give retreats, but you have no idea how many times I've been excommunicated. And he said, I don't care about that. So out of that has come a whole new opportunity to serve. And that's what it is. It's an opportunity to serve. I give a lot of retreats every year, and I love to do it. I love to be of service. I keep telling the guys that I give retreats to, I'm taking resumes, because the last guy, he left it 9 years ago, and I haven't found another one. But I'm doing very well, I hate to tell you. See, I think relationship, you learn certain things, and you learn certain things being alone, because you have to learn certain things in order to live alone, as you know, and live your spiritual life without a mate. I want to tell you about my sister Dora, because I know time has gone on. Dora died 3 years ago, and for me, that was, you know, because I was thinking last night, I didn't get to say goodbye to my mother. I hadn't changed yet. I was still drugging and drinking when my mother died. And my father was gone, and I owed them amends, my God, because of the way I treated them. And when Keith was talking last night, I was thinking of this, and I thought, you know what, I must tell you about Dora's death, because this to me is the way Alcoholics Anonymous works. I had, from one of these retreats I gave, some women asked me to do a big book study with them, and I did. And one of the women one day called me and she said, my mother just died, and she said, I wanted to phone you and tell you how this all went. She said, my mother just died 2 hours ago, and you were the first one I wanted to call, because she said, you played such an important part in my being with my mother as she died. I thought, what's that about? I have never talked about death. I've never been at a deathbed. And she went on to say, I just knew how to be. Her mother had Alzheimer's, and she said, we stroked her and we sang to her and I talked with her right to the end, etc. And she said, I learned that all from doing the big book study with you, so I want to thank you. See, God's ways, nothing is ever lost. About 6 months later, I needed that information because my brother-in-law phoned me. When my parents died, they would not have Dora in an institution. The sister who's next to me, she and her husband, they took Dora in, and she lived with them for 29 years. They had 5 little children when they took her in, and they made her part of the family, and the children made her part of the family. And I often say, if there are angels on the planet, they're it. And my brother-in-law called me and said, if you want to see Dora, she's dying. Now, how is it that there were 2 of my sponsees at my house that night? They put me to bed, and the next morning they were there, and they got me a ticket, and they packed my suitcase, and they got me to the airport. And I have to tell you, I was coward enough that I was hoping that Dora would be gone when I got there. I'm not proud of that, but I was shaking inside because Dora was such a big part of my life. I got off the plane and my brother was there to pick me up, and he said, Dora's still alive. And he took me to the hospital, and an amazing thing happened. I got to the threshold of the room and all fear left me. And all I could hear was the voice of my friend saying, we stroked her, and we sang to her, and we talked to her. And I got to stand at Dora's deathbed for the last 18 hours of her life. And we sang to her songs I hadn't thought about, you know, to the Blessed Virgin. We said prayers I hadn't said for ever so long. And I stayed with her all night, and I talked to her. She was unconscious, but I talked to her, and I tried to help her get ready for that big journey that she was about to take. And I held her hand all night. And then in the morning, they took the life support system away. And when she was about 20 minutes from her end, my sister-in-law was there. A sister-in-law I didn't like. At one point, as a matter of fact, my sister had been planning a dinner party, and I said, who's invited? And she told me, and the sister-in-law was on the guest list. And I said, do we have to have her? And my sister had said, yes. She said, why not? I said, well, she's so pretentious, and she's always telling us how rich they are, etc. And my sister said, she only acts that way when you're around. This was the sister-in-law who, about 20 minutes before Dora died, said to Dora, she said, swallow, it'll be easier to breathe. And Dora did. And about 10 minutes before she died, she said again to her, because I had been thinking, I wish that I had some way of knowing that Dora had heard what I said to her all night, because I did a life review with her, is really what I did, and kept reassuring her and telling her how much I loved her. And then she died. And I have to tell you that if you ever want to experience the fourth dimension, where you can feel its presence, you feel it when somebody dies. Isn't that true? You know that you're in the presence of God. You're in the presence of something so awesome and so beautiful that it's you just stand there in silence. And in the silence, out of this silence, I heard my sister say, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have anything that you haven't given me, you know. I said to her after a while, what made you say that? And she said, because, like our father said of our brother, you have been transformed. And without you, she said, I don't know. I wouldn't have known what to do at that deathbed. And she said, it's all about Alcoholics Anonymous in your life. And I said, yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And when I got back to Toronto, I saw my spiritual director, and I was telling him, I wished that I knew that Dora had heard me, and he said, "You dummy, you really are thick." I said, "Why do you say that?" He said, "Well, how did she swallow when Agnes said to her, 'Dora, you can swallow, it'll make it easier to breathe'?" She was hearing what was being said. You know, the God that I have come to believe in, I think, is in this room, because I think that God is everywhere. And I think that's really the healing that takes place, that God is in you, that God is in me. That's what the book says. Thank goodness Chuck told me that. Thank goodness he had read the book, because it says deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. The great reality is in each of us. And that is the reality that I have found here. I have been, through giving retreats, I've been able to let those walls down so that now when I sit among you, I'm with you. I'm not here as a shell. I'm here absorbing who you are and giving to you of what I am, of who I am, which I think is the presence of God. That's why I think Bill put that prayer of St. Francis in the book, in the step 3, step 11, in the 12 and 12. Because as we come here, we open that channel. The good isn't out there. Nobody out there has my good. It's all within, because the great reality lives within. And as I open that channel to give to you, it flows back to me, and that's how it goes. And the more we open that channel to give love and to give forgiveness and to give the light and to give whatever it is that our brother needs, we begin to see the goodness that has always been within us. And then we begin to see that we do walk in the fourth dimension right now, and that the whole gift of this program is that spiritual awakening. The new pair of glasses that we truly put on, where we begin to see, and it doesn't have to come out of a bottle, and it's limitless, that God is good, life is wonderful, you are wonderful, I am wonderful, and everything is working out just as it should. And that is what I believe this program does slowly. We look for it in a bottle, and now we can get this, and it never empties out, and it's always with us. And that is the joy that I wish for every one of you. And thank you for being such a wonderful audience and having me here.